Deborah Herman, who has recently researched Dear Abby and the changing advice of the advice columnists. This report on the Dear Abby column was produced for Fresh Air by Charles Hardy, who is WUHY's resident expert on popular culture and the host of the Popular Culture Show, which you can hear every Thursday on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock.
Dear Mr. Popular Culture, while watching the last episode of Barney Miller last Thursday, I burst into tears, overwhelmed with the senselessness and insanity of our modern culture. It seems that all the good programs are being taken off the air. First Lou Grant, now Taxi and Flamingo Road have already been canceled, and we all know that MASH will be the next to go. And it's not just the television programs. Sirhan Sirhan says Bobby Kennedy would want him to be released, and people are paying attention to him. WABC has gone to all talk radio. They're putting commercials on public television, and it's in to be in the armed forces again. I just don't understand what is going on and feel so lost and confused. Can you help me? Signed, Bewildered in Bethlehem. You know, I get a lot of letters like this one from people who are having problems with their fast foods, who don't understand the new music crazes, or who are just having difficulty adjusting to new television programs. You know, people experiencing different types of cultural angst. And I like to try and help them. For many Americans, cultural change is very disturbing. But the volume of letters I get is really minuscule in comparison to those received by the interpersonal and lovelorn advice columnists. Now, people have always needed advice. But it wasn't until the last few decades before the Civil War that a real market for this sort of literature developed in America. It seems that during this period of economic takeoff, social change, and rapid mobility, Americans, torn loose from parents, the old community, and the values of the early republic, began turning to books for advice on how to behave and deport themselves. Problems of appropriate social behavior were the overriding concern of the emerging bourgeois society. Ever since then, we've always relied upon the advice of experts for bringing up our kids, getting rich, being liked, having better sex, you name it. But apparently it wasn't until the 1880s that a regular advice column for women appeared in American newspapers. It was during this decade that some savvy editors realized that a woman's page interesting females to read newspapers would attract advertisers' income. According to historian Deborah Herman, the first advice column for women appeared in the New York World in November of 1883. But firsts are always being challenged, so a better year to remember is 1895. For it was in that year that Elizabeth Gilmer began an advice column for the New Orleans Picayune under the name of Dorothy Dix. Gilmer's column would run for 55 years, syndicated throughout the nation, and eventually making her the highest-paid woman writer in America, pulling down some $90,000 annually by the early 1940s. Since then, her throne of preeminent popularity has been divided between the sisters Anne and Abigail. Now, advice columns are tremendously rich cultural documents, reflecting as they do a sort of widely accepted, I guess we could say for argument's sake, a consensus opinion on changing social attitudes and practices. And as such, they can be valuable material for the student of American popular culture. As an example of one way these columns might be used to elucidate the same, let's take a listen to Deborah Herman, an historian at the University of Georgia, who at the 1982 Popular Culture Convention took a look at married life in mid-20th century America through an examination of 6 months of Dear Abby's columns in 1956.
If we accept Letters to Dear Abby as an accurate indicator, in 1956, a single American woman approached life with one overriding purpose in mind, to find the right man and convince or coerce him to marry her. In the minds of most, this goal was not easily fulfilled. Single women competed for what they perceived to be a limited number of eligible men. Further complicating the situation was the fact that women's eagerness for marriage was thought to be countered by men's reluctance to wed. As Abby noted, though many a young man desired a little romance for himself, many felt less than certain of the virtues of matrimony. For women, the road to the altar was no primrose path. How, one writer asked, could a woman know if her man had serious intentions, that is, matrimony, or just wanted to horse around, in the words of one reader? An effective assessment was vital to a woman's future. She could not afford to squander her youth on relationships that were going nowhere, yet she must also avoid the aggressive behavior that would label her as a pushy woman. Most importantly, if a relationship soured, a woman must learn to cut her losses and move on. She would not, after all, as Abby cautioned, be young forever. Perhaps the greatest challenge facing the single woman stemmed from her need to be irresistible to the man of her choice while effectively resisting or at least limiting his advances. The contemporary wisdom went like this: if a man could get what he wanted from a woman without benefit of matrimony, why bother with a wedding ring? Marge, 30 and dating the same man for 10 years, provided a case in point. She wrote Abby that, "I have been faithful to him and he seems content with me. I work, but every night I cook his dinner at my apartment and take care of his needs. I do everything for him that a good wife would do, but whenever I mention marriage, he blows up." In performing the duties of a wife while unmarried, Marge forfeited the single woman's basic advantage, the ability to withhold her favors. Three somewhat more astute high school seniors seeking to avoid a similar dilemma asked Abby, just how far should a girl go? They wrote, "We have been told that if a girl shows a boy too much affection, she is considered casual, and no nice boy will have anything to do with her. Then on the other hand, if we don't show the boy some affection, they won't ask us out again. We want to be popular." Abby's solution to this dilemma was simple in theory, if not in practice. The girl who wanted to be popular but protect her reputation needed, in Abby's words, to leave something for the boys to come back for. Okay, despite the fact that it was not an easy task for a woman to find a husband, not any man would do, and this is a theme that also comes up in the columns. I'm going to skip some of the material I have here, but I just want to point out that you can't marry somebody who has the wrong political attitudes, certainly the wrong race. And it's also not possible, or it's not approved of, for you to marry someone, or let me put this a little bit differently, for you to get involved in a relationship which defies the conventional standards. One example of this is provided by a woman in her early 40s who wrote Abby that she had met two young men at a dance and was considering sharing their apartment in order to save money. She said that she was not interested in what people will say, but only in whether or not the arrangement could work out. Abby's response was unequivocal, and she stated that whether or not this was practical, that it was certainly immoral. And what this example makes clear, I think, is that part of the reason that women are intensely eager for matrimony is that marriage exists not in a range of alternatives, but as the only generally acceptable alternative to the single life. And this fact explains why the woman who couldn't get the man she wanted very often felt compelled to settle for the man who was available. Now, in the case of why men are reluctant to wed, this is a question that I think Dear Abby is less illuminating on, partly because of the fact that whereas married men write in fairly frequently, letters from single men are less common. I think, this is speculation on my part, that men were generally reluctant to take on the responsibilities for marriage, the responsibilities for supporting a family. And compared to single women, they had fewer anxieties about the prospects that they could always find a partner if they wanted to, and their attentions were very much in demand, or at least this was the perception. So this may explain some of the reason why men are not as eager to get married in the mid-50s, or at least apparently are not. If we look at married life, however, you see that the situation of the two sexes is rather different. While the single woman eagerly awaited her wedding day, married life, Letters to Dear Abby revealed, often failed to live up to her expectations. For the married woman, family responsibilities became the center, if not the whole, of her existence. Abby discouraged wives from working outside the home, even where childcare did not present a problem, and the wife's income could have contributed significantly to the family's living standard. When one wife suggested that a night out would help her to forget her troubles, Abby seconded her husband's objections. Stay home and care for your family, she advised, and you will have fewer troubles to forget. In another case, an intellectual type who became so engrossed in her reading that she neglected to prepare her husband's dinner was told to start being a wife or risk losing her husband. For some women, running a household, raising children, and probably holding paid employment as well proved overwhelming. An old-fashioned wife found herself too tired after washing, ironing, cooking, cleaning, and gardening all day to go square dancing with her husband. He put in an 8-hour day while she worked 16. Wives whose interests took them away from familial duties drew husband's anger and Abby's disapproval. One woman became so involved in church work, civic activities, and a bridge club that she forgot her work at home. Her husband wrote Abby, "She comes home at 6:45, throws a cold meat sandwich together, and serves it with potato chips on a paper plate. This is dinner. If I want a decent meal, I have to take her out. She gets a liberal allowance to run the home, but she's never home to do it." While women were expected to subordinate personal desires to family life, men's preferences, in contrast, took precedence over all other considerations. One woman described herself as fed up after moving 16 times in 9 years for the sake of her husband's career. Yet Abby advised that he had to come first, and this is despite her complaints that it was bad for the children. The wife of a good-looking playboy was informed that while a leopard might never change his spots, she must learn to live with them. Graceful acceptance of the inevitable was the hallmark of a good wife. Despite the family's acknowledged patriarchal structure, wives did, in some cases, exert considerable influence. To the extent that a husband desired his wife's love and approval, he granted her a degree of control over family life. Wives sometimes gained power through sheer intransigence. For example, a wife who went bowling with friends one night a week repeatedly returned home late. Her husband established a midnight curfew, which she did not tolerate. When he locked her out of the house, she simply went home to mother. Control of family purse strings also represented an area in which male prerogative presumably gave men control over their wives' activities. But even here, it turns out that a husband's control could prove tenuous in certain cases. With money a symbol of status and power, many men felt compelled to fulfill their spouse's every desire, partly as a way of affirming their own success. And here, I might refer you to Thorsten Veblen's writings on this subject. This could lead to problems, however, as one San Franciscan discovered when his wife began running up charge account bills as if she was married to a millionaire. In some cases, men voluntarily gave up control of family finances to wives who they regarded as better money managers. But these men generally tended to be uneasy about their actions and preferred their wives to exercise their power unobtrusively. Direct challenges to the husband's authority most often took place in the household, woman's acknowledged domain. One wife, an ex-WAC captain, ran her home like an army post, much to her husband's distress. Yet Abby advised him that women secretly like to take orders from a man if he will stand up and give them. Besides, as husband, Abby claimed, he outranks her. Such beliefs represented the major ideological and psychological support for the husband in his effort to dominate the wife. If he could ignore what she said and rely on her presumed desire to be subordinate, he need not feel like an oppressor, for she merely got what she wanted. The stresses involved in an unending jockeying for position and power must have been considerable in many marriages. husbands and wives may in some cases have been evenly matched when it came to verbal conduct, combat, and strategic maneuvering, but women frequently found themselves at a disadvantage when marital disputes led to physical confrontations. In a rage, one husband hit his wife with a lamp. A husband with a terrible Irish temper regularly punched his wife around. Angered when he found holes in his socks and a button missing from his shirt, another punched his wife in the nose. Yet another beat up his wife for what she termed no good reasons. The first three wives all expressed uncertainty about their right to protest such behavior. The last woman repeatedly forgave her mate his periodic fits of violence. Abby advised the wife of the man with the Irish temper, that the woman who sticks around after such treatment will only find sympathy in the dictionary. In contrast, the woman who failed to darn her husband's socks was informed that she had no problem other than neglect of wifely duties. Not surprisingly, when romance went out of a relationship, one or both partners often looked elsewhere for satisfactions missing in their marriages. The impulse toward infidelity commonly stemmed from the feeling that one's spouse was no longer the person one had married. After years of marriage, a woman seldom looked or acted in the same way she had as a newlywed. She might have gained weight, neglected her appearance, or lost interest in sex. Nor was hubby Prince Charming as many young brides might have hoped. He gambled, drank too much, failed to fulfill his promises, proved unable to hold a job, lied compulsively, refused to take a bath, watched TV all night in his underwear. The complaints that appear in the column are virtually endless. For the disenchanted, faithlessness was often quite easily justified, as in the case of one 55-year-old man who was enamored of his son's 18-year-old girlfriend. He explained, "My wife is stout, and I can't stand stout women. This girl is exciting and makes me feel young again." The possibility of infidelity meant that husbands and wives had a difficult time trusting one another. The women their husbands met at work were often the object of many wives' jealous concern. Abby advised wives not to meddle in their husbands' affairs, at least not until they had ample evidence of hanky-panky. But even the wife who had no proof of her husband's faithlessness often felt compelled to stick it out. Excuse me, who had proof. Sometimes she did so for the sake of the children, sometimes out of a hope of reforming her errant mate. Some wives claimed to be mystified by the type of woman their husbands chose as lovers. "What can those cheap girls offer him that I can't?" wondered one. Another suggested that she might have forgiven her mate had he picked out a decent, respectable girl. Yet obviously no woman involved in an affair with a married man could have qualified as respectable in most eyes, at least not in this period. Men also worried about their wives' fidelity, but their concerns often were tinged with a kind of ludicrous quality. For example, even after 50 years of marriage, Daddy worried about the report of a friend that Mommy was playing around. In another case, a husband's suspicions grew out of his apparent ignorance of the demands of caring for a home and young children. He wrote Abby, "When I come home at night, my wife is always so dead tired that I wonder if maybe she isn't favoring someone else with her affections during the daytime. I realize she has a lot to do in this big house with seven kids, but can a woman be this worn out from this alone?" Extramarital relationships were least threatening when they remained clandestine. The rare spouse who openly confessed a desire to have relationships with other men or women most likely merely confused his or her husband or wife. While some might wonder if this was indeed the modern way, Abby had no doubt that it was not. Unabashed disavowal of the rules was extremely disturbing. The husband or wife caught in the act might recant their sins or protest that love overrode marital vows, but the spouse who claimed the right to extramarital relationships challenged the whole conception of marriage. When marriages did fail, it was most often the cumulative effect of multiple problems. But expected never to abandon hope that their marriages could be saved, most women felt that they had to endure the unendurable. One wife cited the lack of support, association with a no-good crowd, excessive drinking, and possible bigamy as her husband's major flaws. Yet she asked Abby for help in resisting his demand for a divorce so that she might preserve her marriage. Despite the difficulties and disappointments of married life, spouses were expected to maintain faith in the viability of the institution. Finally, women so often disillusioned by their own marriages were expected not to communicate such feelings to their daughters. Mothers may know from sad experience that the white-hot flame of love will soon die out, but as Abby warned, she must not sour her daughter on romance. Well, married life, as pictured in Dear Abby, clearly involved disappointment for both sexes. The evidence indicates, however, that wives must have been the more acutely disillusioned, since as single women they had held a highly positive view of marriage, in contrast to their future husbands, who had exhibited a reluctance to marry that reflected possibly their understanding that marriage entailed potential disadvantages as well as gains. A close reading of the complaints lodged by husbands and wives, however, reveals another reason for women's disenchantment. While men tended to direct their complaints toward their particular spouse, women's problems often transcended the peculiarities of their partner and stemmed ultimately from the nature of the institution of marriage, particularly that of the role of wife. In general, men's complaints about marriage centered on the shortcomings of their partners and the difficulties of enforcing their male prerogatives on recalcitrant spouses. Men wanted, it seems, wives they considered attractive and who would perform a woman's traditional domestic duties efficiently and without complaint. Men's complaints generally reflected a wife who had lost her beauty, neglected her responsibilities, or refused to defer to his wishes. For these men, infidelity or remarriage, especially to a younger, more attractive, or a more compliant mate, provided a means of replacing what he regarded as essentially a defective wife and thereby restoring his faith in the institution. In contrast, a woman's problems were far less likely to stem from the specific characteristics of her own mate, though certainly I don't want to claim that these were not contributing factors, but it seems to me that they are, at least in part, structurally inherent in the role of wife. The proper 50s wife was expected to be deferential to her husband, whatever his character defects or weaknesses. Should she rebel, he presumed the right and often had the means to compel her compliance. Even with a lenient or understanding mate, she was saddled with major responsibility for household chores and child rearing, whether she worked outside the home or not. As Abby remarked, marriage isn't a 50-50 proposition, it's more like 80-20, and the little woman is at the long end of the arithmetic. But if it was marriage itself that stood at the heart of women's problems, I think few understood this fact. As advice columns like Dear Abby indicate, individual experience was understood through the distorting filter of social stereotypes and societal expectations. Personal experience seldom led individuals to challenge cultural definitions of their roles because that experience was itself understood in terms of those definitions. Women lamented their own unhappy marriages, but few criticized the institution itself. As John Stuart Mill has commented, though women do not complain of the power of husbands, each complains of her own husband or of the husbands of her friends. Dear Abby, I think, bears out Mill's observation. But it also suggests, I think, that what was startling about a work like Betty Friedan's 1963 critique of the American housewife situation, The Feminine Mystique, was not its charge that large numbers of housewives were unhappy. Readers of Dear Abby were already well apprised of this fact. Indeed, I think the expectation of happiness in marriage is largely the single woman's myth, a myth that is individually and perhaps inevitably punctured for women by the experience of marriage. Instead, I think Friedan's impact came from the explanation she gave for this unhappiness and from her insistence that it was intolerable and could be avoided. Furthermore, Friedan suggests that unhappiness in marriage was endemic to the institution itself rather than an affliction striking only the unwisely married. She held that unhappiness had come to be the standard condition of the American wife, not the price paid by a mismated few. In short, Friedan challenges the rules and called for a redefinition of women's obligations and opportunities as wife. And in so doing, in essence, she usurps the columnist's role and offers a new set of rules, a new means for interpreting women's experience in marriage, and thereby called for major social changes initiated by women on their own behalf.
Dear Abby, my feet are too long. My hair is falling out and my rights are all wrong. My friends, they all tell me that I've no friends at all. Won't you write me a letter? Won't you give me a call? Signed, Bewildered.
You've been listening to Deborah Herman, an historian at the University of Georgia who spoke at the 1982 Popular Culture Convention on Married Life in 1950s America, as seen through the columns of Dear Abby.
Stop wishing for bad luck and knocking on wood. Dear Abby, my fountain pen leaks. My wife hollers at me and my kids are all freaks. Every side I get up on is the wrong side of bed. If it weren't so expensive, I'd wish I were dead. Signed, unhappy. Unhappy.
That was John Prine asking for that advice from Dear Abby. Charles Hardy produced the talk that we just heard on the columns of Dear Abby, and Charles will be with us tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock for this week's edition of the Popular Culture Show. It's 2.5 minutes after 3, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Well, Abigail Van Buren started writing her column after learning the profession from her twin sister, Esther Lederer, who began to write her syndicated advice column in 1955 under the name Ann Landers. And when she started, she described herself as a square Jewish girl from Iowa. Well, Margot Howard is the daughter of the woman we know as Ann Landers, and she's just written a biography of her mother. It's called Epi, The Story of Ann Landers, and it's published by Putnam. Margot Howard, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How does it make you feel to hear someone like we just heard discussing in sociological terms the meaning of advice columns?
Well, it's interesting because the advice column has been here for a long time and is here to stay. And it does indicate popular culture to a greater or lesser degree. And there have been other serious studies done about the column and what it says about how we're living.
Well, the talk that we just heard was about the woman we know as Abigail Van Buren, who's the twin of your mother. And we'll talk a little bit about their relationship a little bit later. Do you feel that your mother's advice in her columns has changed a lot since she started in the mid-50s?
It has changed certainly some. I don't know if it's changed a lot. She has been able to change her views almost because she sees the way the culture is moving, and she's had to change. She's updated her ideas about divorce, for example. In the early days of her writing, she always took the position that it didn't matter what was going on, you should work it out and hang in there, and married was married. And that started to change, I think, with my first divorce, when she realized that if people were ill-suited, they should get another chance. And why should you hang in there? It wasn't even something that you needed to do for children, because a home where there was tumult and tension did not help the children.
Well, when she had her divorce, she wrote a whole column on it. It was an interesting column. Did that shake her up a lot, and do you think that
Yes. Yes, she never expected to be divorced. Never intended for that to happen. She was very surprised by it. But when the dust settled, she had the feeling that she'd been married for 36 years, and she figured that about 32 of those years were really quite good married years. And it was a long time, and she knew that, and she thought, well, maybe that's all you get.
What about the functioning of marriages and the role of the woman within marriage? Did her take on that change during the decades that she's written her advice column?
I don't exactly understand.
Has the advice your mother has given to women in marriages change in the past few decades. Has she seen the role of women in marriage as changing, or the responsibility of the man in marriage as changing?
That's interesting. I don't know how to answer that because I've never evaluated her work that way. My instinct would be to say no, that she sees the roles as what they always were.
Because like in the Dear Abby, one of the examples that the woman who we just heard gave was a man who said that, you know, his wife was an ex-whack and she ran the house like an army. And he was really frustrated. What could he do? And Abby responded, and this is in the mid-50s, well, women really love to take orders from men. You know, if you're just like strong enough to give them, she'll really love to take them.
Oh, mother's not into that. No, and never has been. Maybe she was more modern on that subject years ago.
Well, she was a working woman at a time when not that many women worked, certainly not nearly as many as today. I'm sure a lot of women wrote to her with questions about whether it would be okay to go to work. What would she say to a question like that?
She always thought it was fine to work, although she doesn't exactly regard herself as a working woman. It's interesting. She is not a feminist at all. She feels that anybody who wants to work will work. And she never used the movement for anything, although she was quite established by the time that got any currency.
What couldn't she write about when she started the column?
Interesting, in the 50s, newspapers could not discuss VD or homosexuality. The words couldn't be mentioned, and you certainly couldn't talk about it at any length. Couldn't give advice about it because you couldn't talk about it.
Would it have been something she wanted to talk about if it wasn't for the newspaper?
Oh, yes. She always wanted to talk about everything.
Did she get letters that she couldn't print because of that, or did
yes.
people know to not bother
no,
to ask?
No, people didn't know that it could never show up. But from the beginning, she always answered letters with a name and address. So if people were serious, they could get the help. They just couldn't read the letter in the paper.
Oh, so she answered the letters independently of the paper?
Always, because she regarded this as a service business. It mattered to her that if people were writing for help, that they got some help.
Tell us the story of how she first started to write the Ann Landers column.
She won it in a contest, actually. I found a man on a train when I was 12 years old who became a great friend of ours. And it turned out that he was a very powerful executive in the field newspaper enterprise. And when we moved to Chicago, 3 years after we met him, mother had been effectively aced out of political work because she'd been in politics in Wisconsin, and she couldn't continue in Chicago. It was just way over her head. It was machine politics with Jake Arvey and Richard Daley, and they weren't looking for women, and they sure weren't looking for her. The tradition of the La Follette Democrats in Wisconsin was very different than the Chicago machine. So the Ann Landers column, which was then done by a nurse newspaper woman, and it was an anonymous small feature, anonymously written, I should say. That feature caught her eye, and she called this chum of ours with the field papers, and she said, I will help Ann Landers answer the mail, because there was a slug at the bottom of that column that said, if you send a name and address, we'll answer your problem. And he was very startled to hear from her then, because he told her Ann Landers had died the week before she was calling. And now there was nobody to help. And mother very brashly said, well, if I can't be assistant to anyone, I'll just do the column. And he laughed. He said, that's crazy. You're not able to do that. You're not equipped to do it, and we're not going to let you. And then she pestered him, and she said, well, how are you picking the new Ann Landers? And he said, we're having kind of a contest. There were 20-some women, all but three of whom were newspaper women. And the three women who were not were executives' wives, who thought it would be fun to do. So because of the presence of the executives' wives in the contest, they couldn't use names. They used coded numbers. And they kept winnowing down. It was down to 10, it was down to 5, it was down to 4. And when they got the one they wanted, and they were all working from the same letters, these contestants, they decoded it, and it was my mother. And they said, you can't have it because you're not trained and your husband's very successful. You won't stick with it. And she drove them crazy. She said, I want it, and it's mine, and you have to give me a chance. They let her try, but without a contract. They were waiting for her to fold. And she knew how to build it into something, and she's been at it 27 years now, and she has a contract.
When she started doing it, it was understood that this was a name that people had when they had the job, and that, you know, mm-hmm. the columnists really came and went, but the name Ann Landers,
she was the third,
stayed the same.
Yeah.
And because of that, you weren't supposed to have a visual identity. She had a maintain her identity a secret for a while, but she wanted publicity, and she got the publicity. How did she get it, and why did she want it?
The first time that she was known to be the Ann Landers creator was when she went on What's My Line, and there was a big battle. The paper didn't want her to, and she said, look, it's important. She said, I can do a better job if there's some feel for this column, if people have an idea who the lady is. She wanted to run a picture, which she finally did, and when she beat them over the head to please let her go on What's My Line, they said, all right, we're not sure where this is going to take us, but go do it. And as it happened, when she did that show, Fred Allen, who was a mainstay of What's My Line, had died 2 days before the show. And the country almost entirely was watching to see what Fred Allen's chums would do. And Mother was a guest on that show, and everybody knew that she was the one. And that was the beginning of the big publicity. And that's also the beginning of Ann Landers as a big property, because when she took it over, it had, I think, 40 papers in the syndicate stable. And today she has over 1,000. So she knew what she was doing.
Her greatest competition comes from her twin sister, who we know as Abigail Van Buren. How did she get into the profession?
How did Abby get into it? She followed her sister into it. They were madly competitive because they were identical twins, and they had a queer childhood. They had a mother who didn't understand anything about identity and ego and individuality, and these girls dressed alike and carried one pocketbook and had one escort for school dances because it looked cute. You see, they were darling-looking, so they stuck a boy in the middle. They each didn't have a date for a lot of things, and everything was how it looked. And they didn't acknowledge the fact that they were competitive for many years. And my mother acknowledged it much before my aunt. So when my mother distinguished herself, yet again, by starting an advice column, Popo, which is our family name for the Dear Abby person, followed her into it. And she picked one of the few businesses in the country where there was usually a paper across the street. And she sold herself to the San Francisco Chronicle by saying, look, this girl's making a name for herself, Ann Landers. I am her twin sister. We have the same humor, the same intelligence, the same instincts. I can do what she is doing. And to her credit, she did. She was able to sustain it, although the emphasis in their work is quite different.
What's the difference in their styles?
My mother is acknowledged to be, and not by me, I might say, she's acknowledged to be the more serious of the two. She has a sense of mission. She cares about doing good and doing a service and helping people and finding answers. And my aunt is more theatrically oriented. She has a lot of punchlines that she likes. She goes for jokes. Some help is coming out of there. But her tilt is more to entertainment than my mother's.
Did you say she's acknowledged by most to be more serious, but not by me?
No, what I meant was I was not saying to you she's acknowledged to be the more serious writer. I didn't mean this is my judgment. This is a judgment of professionals, you know, doctors and social workers and that kind of group.
Do you think they have a different set of morals?
Yes, I find them different girls in terms of personality. They live differently. They have different values. Although they're twins and alike in many, many ways, they are two different women.
What would the difference be maybe in the advice they'd give to someone with the same problem? Would they have the same stand on what to do in marriage or whether to
see,
work?
See, I'm at a loss here because I don't read
you
Popo.
Don't read
I read my mother,
uh-huh.
But I don't read Popo particularly.
Well, there's a long history of feuds between the two of them. Are they talking now?
Yes. It's controlled. It's not terrific, but it's all right. Popo gave an interview that was very unkind and not really true on a number of levels about a year ago to the Ladies' Home Journal. So Mother cooled it for a while just out of self-protection. And now they're certainly speaking, but every time there's some damage, the relationship, of course, has to suffer.
What are the roots of the feud?
The twinship, the competitive aspects of having been raised that way. Their mother said to them, because the mother loved the idea that she had these good-looking, identical twin daughters, the mother said to them from the time they were very little, you are each half an egg. You love your sister best because you're half an egg. Well, Mother, who I think is the more astute and acute mentality of the two, had the thought when she was somewhat older, late teens, early 20s, could that mean half a person? So she knew she somehow had to distinguish herself from her sister to have a normal, functional life.
Let me reintroduce you, Margo. Margo Howard is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of her new book. The book is called Epi, the Story of Ann Landers, and Ann Landers is Margo Howard's mother. She must have been furious. Your mother must have been furious when the Dear Abby column started.
She was,
she had
indeed.
Kind of taught her, didn't she? She had trained her on her column.
Because when mother started, the field people didn't have a whole lot of faith in her and what she could do. And because it was so important to her that the people who needed help get it, she determined she would answer every letter with a name and address. They gave her no secretarial help, no stamps, no nothing. But she was going to do it. So because she had no secretaries early, she mentioned her concern to Popo. She said, I must get these letters answered, and I'm not sure how I'm going to do it. And Popo said, I'll help. So Mother, of course, was doing the column and answering many, many letters herself, but she would give the overage to Popo so people could have some answer. And then Popo learned how to do it from that and sold herself to the Chronicle.
Do you think of your mother as a prude?
Somewhat. She is kind of an old-fashioned lady who is prissy on occasion. Sometimes she surprises me. She surprises me when she's looser than I expect. But there is a prudish quality to her. This is a lady who, after all, is going to be 64 years old, who was raised in Sioux City, Iowa, and was raised in a different day. I mean, people didn't go to bed with people, as a rule, unless they were married.
What are some of the things that she doesn't believe in and would advise against that you think are perfectly acceptable in society?
Well, how about drinking and smoking? She doesn't drink. She thinks it's terrible. She doesn't smoke. She thinks it's harmful. And she's right, certainly, on a number of levels. But she's very interested in clean, straight, upright living. And she doesn't use profanity, doesn't like to listen to it. So on that level, she is a prude.
She's written a number of booklets, and one of the booklets she wrote when you were growing up was called Necking and Petting, How Far to Go.
Oh, my dear, it was such a hilarity. People thought it was such a funny title. Business guys were sending for it and giving it to other people in the office. I mean, it was just this wonderfully funny title.
Well, how did it make you feel? What did your friends think of it?
The friends were laughing. Everybody was laughing.
Did you try to defend her?
No. In fact, this was a wonderful piece of advice. She told me early, she said, never defend me. And then she took the point further. She said, don't really defend anybody in this life ever. People will take care of themselves or they won't. And it's really a no-win situation to try to defend a relative or a chum, you know.
Were you embarrassed?
I was from time to time, but not terribly. It wasn't a matter of great import to me.
Did she give you advice all the time about how far to go?
Well, as a mother, but not at the end. You know, the Ann Landers person didn't figure into our relationship, and the Ann Landers persona is really quite a bit who she really is. So I never felt that, oh God, if only she weren't writing this thing, she'd leave me alone. I mean, she was that kind of mother. She was always talking to me. I think she tried to be careful about how much advice she threw my way, so that I would listen when I did hear something.
What's some of the advice she's given you? Do you remember?
Oh, I don't. I know, but you know, now you get me. I can't think of a particular situation. But over the years, there have been suggestions, and some I have taken and some not.
When she gets letters in now, she doesn't still answer all of them, or her staff doesn't answer all of them?
Yes, she has a larger staff, certainly. She has 13 people. And anything with a name and address still gets an answer because she hasn't changed her mind about what she's doing and why she's there.
What's her system for sorting the letters? What are the categories, and how does she determine which category each letter fits into?
I don't think they deal with categories in that office. The operation's interesting in that the 1,000 and whatever, I don't know, 1,002 papers, I'm not sure, the papers send their mail to an office that Field runs in a little town outside of Chicago, and there are machines that slit the envelopes and attach the letters to the envelope so they can see everything. And then the open mail is sent to Chicago, and the girls just bundle it, and somebody is looking at all the mail.
How many letters come through a day?
Something more than 1,000 a day.
How can 13 people respond to 1,000 letters a day?
Well, many don't have names and addresses. They're not bound to, you know, deal with every piece of mail, but they sort through looking for who's got a name and address. And then once they start reading that, letters are pulled that might be column material.
What makes a good column letter?
I suppose some sort of mass appeal, something that won't just be interesting to a horticulturist, you know, who's working in black orchids. It has to be a problem that many people will identify with one way or the other. They will have had it, they think they might have it, they're having it now, or it's entertaining, or maybe somebody can learn something from that problem even though they're not having it. It should just be interesting on a broad scale.
Is there any problems keeping it fresh?
How do you mean?
People tend to have the same kinds of problems year
after
year.
This is true. This is true, but some things are hooked up to a particular decade. You know, sensitivity training was not discussed in her mail in the 50s because there wasn't such a thing.
Does she discuss the two things that she couldn't, VD and homosexuality, when
she started? Oh, yes.
What does she have to say on those subjects? What are some examples of advice?
Well,
that
she talks
given?
About herpes quite a bit because it is epidemic, and she does have sort of the sideline health interest. She's very interested in medicine. And she puts out the information that they haven't found a cure, and it's painful, and it's easily spreadable during certain times. That's just an example of how she deals with one social health issue. The homosexuality thing is interesting. She got in a huge fight years ago with the American Psychiatric Association when they decided that it wasn't an illness, that it was an alternate lifestyle. And she said, no, you are wrong. And she's come to have been vindicated, I believe. She was always for rights for homosexuals. She felt that it shouldn't interfere with one's life. She felt that homosexuals should be allowed to teach anywhere. She said, these are not the people who are pestering the children. Her positions are good and solid, but she feels that it's an illness, and she thinks that homosexuals, if they had a choice or were born a different way, would choose to be straight. She doesn't think it's just an alternative choice. She thinks that there's a screw loose, pardon the metaphor. She thinks something is wrong in the thought process or the growing up process. She says it's not a happy way to live, and there's only 1% change rate for people who are terribly motivated.
Does she get a lot of requests for information or advice on that subject?
Yes. It's a terrible problem to a lot of people.
Does everybody know who she is now?
Usually. Her voice is very well known, and her face is better known.
What name does she go by amongst her friends?
Epi, which is why I picked it for the book. That is her real first name to anybody who knows her. So when people say, they holler out, hi, Annie, you know, she'll know it's a fan. But if she hears Epi, she believes it to be a friend.
Well, now I guess everybody's going
to call
her Epi because of the book.
Uh-huh.
It'll confuse her a lot. I did an interview with her once, and I really didn't realize that it was a syndicated name that she had inherited. And
was she in Philadelphia when you interviewed her?
No, it was by telephone. We were doing a Valentine's Day show.
Uh-huh.
And we wanted to talk with her to see what kind of advice she'd been giving lately on the subject of love. So we called her in the office. But mm-hmm. I was embarrassed when I read your book and realized, oh, gosh, this is not really her name. You know, I should have known a little bit more about her.
No.
What did you think of the big scandal, which I thought was planted just to publicize her book?
Oh, you mean Ann Scam?
Yeah, Ann Scam, yes.
Well, we interrupt the Falklands War to bring you news of the recycled letters. It was truly much ado about nothing and a statement of how famous she really is. It got much more time than it merited, and there was a survey done. Somebody told me yesterday that a reader survey done by one of the big newspapers showed that 85% of the people did not care and had no feeling about the fact that letters were repeated without being so identified as previously run letters.
Well, how did she feel about it? Did you talk
she
to her
felt
about that?
Bad that it created such a commotion, and she also felt that it was kind of stinky of the little girl on the little paper who went to AP with this news. And she invited the owner of that paper with an AP guy to her apartment in Chicago. And she said to this fellow who owns the tiny paper, why didn't you call me? Or why didn't you call the syndicate if this was bothersome to you? And he said, oh, I never thought I could get through. So she felt a little done in for somebody else's purposes. But it turned into a great love-in. Much love and affection came her way because of this. And people said, this is crazy. And her friends at the New York Times said, oh, don't worry, Epi. They're picking on us for running old crossword puzzles. It's just, it's a silly thing. And Art Buchwald was very public in print and on the air. He said, I don't like what they're doing to my chum, Epi. You know, this is a great silliness directed against a marvelous woman who's really an institution in America. I mean, everything gets repeated.
Do you think there's anything wrong with repeating it, or do you think that she should or should have labeled them as reprints?
Well, now that I can see and that she can see what this flap was all about, of course you'd say label it. But, you know, I can see how it didn't occur to her that it would be a problem.
Did she read your book?
She did, finally, very late. I sent her The Last Set of Galleys with a note. I said, this is not for your opinion. I'm not interested in how you saw things that I wrote about. I am looking for factual changes. Have I screwed anything up? Have I made 1948, 1952? And she was very good about that, and she sent me back a few changes. There's an example here, by the way. It had to do with how she got the column during this contest. And there was a legal problem, so of course she called Justice Douglas because she knew he was a lawyer. That's the way she operated. She always went right to the top. And the problem that she gave Justice Douglas, I thought, I had grown up thinking it had to do with apples. So in the margin of the galley, she wrote walnuts. You see, that kind of thing that had gotten into my head wrong. Those were the fixes I was looking for.
What worried you most? What did you think she would react badly to? I don't mean factual things, but interpretive aspects.
Well, I worried about the openness with which I dealt with my parents' divorce. And in fact, that did concern her. She has said in a column, I don't know if the column has run yet, but she talks about my book, what it meant to her and what she thinks about it. She said that I was too open for her taste about some personal things like her divorce and her relationship with her sister. But she also feels that it was fair and honest and well-written. And she gave me that. She said, okay, you know, this child was part of our family, and this all happened to her, and it's fair game. She was really quite wonderfully fair about interpreting the book.
You did an advice column for a while.
It was on television. I was a little girl. I was 12, and that was before Mother had given advice. And that was just a fluky thing. And I was in a very small town. I was not giving advice in Philadelphia, for example, on television. It was Eau Claire, Wisconsin, population 32,000.
And you want to tell us the story of how you got that show?
Oh, it was funny. Television was brand new. I had a bit of a radio show, although not formally. I went with my class to WEAU in Eau Claire. The teacher wanted us to see how a radio station worked. And the disc jockey was very nice, and I was asking a million questions. And he said to me, why don't you come back one day? I was 12 or 11, I guess, when this happened. He said, come back, and I'll maybe talk to you on the air. We'll do something. So I did go back to this radio station, and I became somewhat of a regular feature. About two times a week I'd show up, and I don't know what I thought radio was, but I would tell secrets. I'd tell how I skipped the piano lesson to go to the movie, or I skipped the last period art class and went to the stables. I was just shooting my mouth off. And it was very early for television. This was 1952 and 53. And I saw the TV equipment being rolled in. And I knew the manager from hanging around the station. I said, gee, what are you going to have? He said, I don't know, not a whole lot. I said, well, I'll do a show for you. He says, that is ridiculous. I said, well, how could I get a show? He said, well, you'd have to have a sponsor, thinking he could just get rid of me. So I crossed the street from the station where there was the Coca-Cola bottler. And I found their manager. Isn't this nervy as I think about it, this little kid? So I found the manager, the Coca-Cola bottler, and I said, if you'll be my sponsor, I'll do a show for you with the new television equipment across the street. He said, okay. And I went back to the manager, and he nearly dropped dead. I mean, now this kid had actually gotten a sponsor. So he had to let me do something. And I asked three friends to help me. We became a panel. We were Margot's teenage panel, and we weren't quite 13, so we thought it was wonderful to be identified as teenagers. And they solicited mail, which they got, and then we went on the air and got a lot more mail. It was a pretty good feature, although television was very new, I must say. I don't think it could be pulled off today.
You wrote a column, too, for a while to teenagers, I think?
No. When I was a grown-up married person, I went to work at the invitation of the Chicago Tribune, doing very long features. And then because it was popular, they offered me a column. And then I was stolen away by gypsies to change my base. So I moved to the Chicago Daily News to be syndicated. And I wrote, they called it social commentary because I really didn't have a field. I was 28, 29 years old. I mean, I was too old and too dumb to really know what I was doing. So they just let me talk. It was fun.
Do you like giving advice or getting advice?
No. I'm not into advice at all.
Okay. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Margot Howard has been my guest, and her new book is called Epi, The Story of Ann Landers, and it's a biography of her mother, who is known to her friends as Epi. Her mother is known to her readers as Ann Landers, and this new book is published by Putnam. It's 3:30, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, or 91 FM on the dial. In about a half hour, I'll be speaking with Father Joseph Kakalik, who will be stepping down this summer from his position as president of the Philadelphia Council of Neighborhood Organizations.